Welcome to another Scouting Post podcast. This is Kirk Ludeke, and what can I say? The 2015-16 regular season is officially over for the Boston Bruins. For those of you who read my requiem for the 2015-16 Boston Bruins post today on the podcast, well, welcome back. As I promised at the end of that long, lengthy blog post I wrote, I figured I'd go back and fill in some blanks, and then the purpose of this podcast is to address some of the things I didn't say in the post, things that maybe I didn't have time for. And let's face it, again, I mean, there's just so much you can say about a season like this one. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's a game, and you know, the Bruins were a game. I honestly believe that the team tried hard, and the effort was there. But as we got down to the final stretch and we hit crunch time, ultimately Boston's best wasn't enough. Now, one of the things I've picked up in the years that I've been covering the NHL and Boston Bruins hockey going back to the 2000-2001 season is that it isn't as always as simple as the team didn't do what they needed to do to win. I think sometimes there's a tendency to be inwardly focused. When things don't go our way, fans say, well, you know, the Bruins lost that, or their favorite team lost the game. They didn't show up. That's usually the common refrain. And in some cases, that's absolutely true. And then in others, I mean, I think you always have to look at the complete context and understand that the other team gets a vote. And so after going back and rewatching yesterday's game, which was hard to do, and you have to hand it to the Ottawa Senators. They fell behind early on a David Pastrnak goal, which was reviewed and could have possibly been thought of as offside. And certainly Jack Edwards, the NES and play-by-play commentator, thought it could have been offsides, but ultimately it was allowed, and the Bruins had a 1-0 lead. And after one period, the Rangers were up and the Bruins were up, and everything was breaking their way. Until we had a nightmarish second period, and the rest is history. But I think it's important to, you know, sometimes to take a harder look, a deeper look. I think sometimes it's a little too easy to just ascribe basic reasons and motives for why things, you know, don't go the way we want it. And my job here and what I've always taken pride in doing is I just call things as I see it. I try to be fair and honest. And, you know, yesterday wasn't a great day. I'll be frank. I probably had some exchanges on Twitter with a couple folks that I wish I'd handled better. You know, I do try to be fair and honest whenever I have the opportunity. And unfortunately, there are just some people out there that, you know, for whatever reason, feel like poking people in the eye is the way to go. And the bottom line is you're never going to get away from that. That's just the nature of the internet. But I'm not going to apologize for anything. And, you know, I had to block a couple people, and that's okay. It's not usually the way I like to go, but, you know, when people, cry about, you know, perceived insults and perceived this being me treating them unfairly, and then they proceed to do just that. I think it's a bit rich, and I have no time for people who cry victim. So appreciate you joining me on the podcast. Let's break down brass tacks. I ascribed the failure of the Boston Bruins to make the Stanley Cup playoffs for the second year in a row to four key areas. And I won't go into too much detail on the podcast because, quite frankly, we're aware of what happened. Number one, the lack of talent was telling. And it ultimately cost the Bruins their shot, and it caught up to them. And I think we can certainly give the Bruins some credit. For much of the season, they'd never lost more than three consecutive games. And when we were sitting there on March 18th and we were looking at the standings, and we were saying to ourselves, wow, you know, they might do this. They were currently sitting in second place in the Eastern Conference. Behind the Washington Capitals, they had a share of first place in the Atlantic Division. It seemed like they were all but assured of a spot, but that that talent deficit caught up to them at crunch time. They had a California West Coast trip on the heels of a very successful run of games after the trade deadline, where they beat teams like Chicago. They also knocked off Florida and Tampa Bay. I mean, these were teams that they were scrapping with in the Atlantic Division, teams that ultimately went on to win first and second place in the division. And it was looking real good for the Bruins there. And ultimately, they crashed and burned. They lost all three games in regulation. The offense kind of deserted them at a critical moment, and then they proceeded to lose the next two games after that trip to drop five in a row. And although they were able to squeeze some wins in there, they were losing more games and leaving points on the table. And it wasn't so much the losses, but it was how the Bruins were doing that I think was so frustrating for so many of the fans that maybe like me looked at this team coming into the season and didn't really have high expectations, but by March 18th was really starting to come to grips and say to themselves, well, hey, maybe this team, there's more to it than we'd seen. Maybe these guys are for real. Maybe they are going to be able to do it. And ultimately, the top forwards that they had, we're talking about the three 30-goal scorers and Brad Marchand, Patrice Bergeron, Louis Erickson, and then, of course, David Krejci. Those guys generally carried the team for much of the season, and it was impressive. But eventually, they needed to get more production from the other lines. The third line, Ryan Spooner, and then he had a revolving door of mates, Matt Bieleski, and then Jimmy Hayes, Brett Connolly, different players sliding in and out of the lineup, Frank Vetrano. Ultimately, the Bruins didn't get consistent enough production out of the third and the fourth lines. The fourth line, though gritty and energetic, didn't bring much to the table offensively at this crucial stretch of games where the Bruins needed him the most. I like Noel Acciari a lot. I always have. But he's a player that isn't going to get you much offense. We saw this in the NCAA with him. He's not, even at the collegiate level, he's not a guy that was racking up a ton of goals and points. And so we knew that in the pro ranks, he was not going to be a scorer as much as he was going to be a grinder, versatile, smart, physical kind of player that can kill penalties. So I think, at most, assuming that he can come back and be hungry and win that fourth line center job next year, you're probably looking at 10 goals from Noel Acciari and that, over the course of a season, maybe not even 10. And that'll be, that's probably the high end. I mean, maybe 15. I think if we ever saw Noel Acciari hit 20 goals, he'd be completely exceeding his expectations. Doesn't make him a bad player. But as long as they're putting him where he really should be, which is that fourth line, then the Bruins will be fine. But ultimately, I think the forwards just couldn't those top four players couldn't get it done at crunch time yesterday. We saw David Pastrnak come through in the clutch on a great pass from Brad Marchand. It was kind of an aerial alley-oop. But unfortunately, Louis Erickson, Patrice Bergeron, David Krejci, they were nowhere to be found, really. They had some good chances, but they just couldn't finish them off. And that was really the story of the season offensively. No finish when the team needed it the most. And even though the team finished near the top echelon of the NHL in scoring as a team, when the Bruins truly needed that production, they just didn't get it. Now we'll talk briefly about the defense. Hey, look, we knew it was an issue. It was problematic. They lost Johnny Boychuk and Dougie Hamilton in the last 2 years. They didn't replace them with anyone. I mean, when Matt Irwin is your only off-season free agent signing of note, you're taking a big risk. And, it was okay because at the time because they had Joe Morrow and Zach Trotman. You had Colin Miller coming over in the Milan Lucic trade. There was an opportunity for Boston to fill some holes internally. And I think a source of a lot of the angst with the fans is that those, at least two of those three players in terms of Morrow and Miller, didn't get enough of an opportunity during the season. I'll address that more when I talk about Claude Julien, but the bottom line is the Boston defense just was porous. It was inconsistent. Zdeno Chara, as much as you respect his body of work and what he's accomplished over the years, it's he's in the twilight, and he needed help. He needed a better supporting cast. Dennis Seidenberg, ever since that catastrophic knee injury he suffered, he's just not been the kind of player the Bruins were banking on him being when Peter Chiarelli signed him to the four-year, $4 million per extension back in early 2014. And the list goes on and on. I mean, Tory Krug is probably deserving of his own podcast. It really disappoints me to see the level of critiques and negative remarks I see people make about him. But I get it. I mean, he's an undersized defenseman, and so I truly believe that if he were 6'1 or 6'2 and doing the things he was doing, he would be one of the most popular players on the various internet fan and message boards, and people would love him, and he would be able to do no wrong. But because he's 5'9", everyone's always trying to throw dirt on it over his grave and move him out of town and this, that, and the other thing. It's really a shame. I mean, I think if all of these fans that are so critical of Tory Krug, you know, took a moment to really pay attention to what he does and are honest about it. I mean, I know there's going to be some people listening to this podcast and they're going to say to themselves, oh, well, I do watch the game. You know, I think, a lot of people have just really decided well in advance forever, for whatever reason, they've taken a public position that Tory Krug is just not a top defenseman in this league. And therefore, the Bruins have no business paying him X, Y, and Z. Bottom line, guys, Tory Krug deserves at least $5 million on his next deal. I hope the Bruins give it to him because he's earned it. And he's a heck of a player, given his lack of size, what he's been able to accomplish. I mean, never mind the four goals this season. That's an aberration. He's not going to be a 1% shooter going forward. I mean, the bottom line is he's such a character guy, a leader. He inspires. Is he perfect? No. No player's perfect. But I think that fans that get on Tory Krug's case or scapegoat him, they're missing the forest for the trees. But that's just my opinion. Like I said, what I need to do is get a advanced stats and go to work and research Tory Krug so that I can make a more convincing case than emotion, because emotion doesn't sell. But I've been around Tory well before he made it big. He's the same guy. He's always been driven by the doubters, and that's okay. If you want to doubt him, do so at your own peril. The Bruins would be in a much bigger hurt box had they not had him this season, I can tell you that much. And then, of course, McQuaid and Kevin Miller, good guys, rugged guys. McQuaid signed a cap extension hit that's not ideal, and Kevin Miller's been in and out of the lineup, and he certainly has been known to have some issues on defense. But at the end of the year, Miller was one of the more dependable, steady defensive defensemen on this team. It's just unfortunate the way it all came out. Second point is Claude Julien. Absolutely should be held accountable for what happened. He's the coach. He's responsible for what the team does and fails to do ultimately. But man, it's awfully hard to score goals from the bench or block shots from the bench. And I think, you know, given that he did his level best with what he was given to work with, you know, he deserves a pat on the back and a firm handshake, and not a boot in the butt out the door. But it certainly looks like the Bruins are leaning towards making him the convenient target for the failure, and I get that. I think accountability is important. I think one of the challenges we have in sports and breaking down sports and analysis in general is extremes. And believe me, I understand. You know, fan comes from the word fanatic. Some people are just not going to be reasonable no matter how much effort you put into presenting a convincing case with rational thought and evidence behind it. They're not going to buy it. I get it. But extremes on both sides aren't good. And I think that, the extreme that says, well, you know, Claude Julien is the coach and, the players go out and play and therefore the coach isn't responsible for any of this, that's incorrect. He is the coach. Of course he bears responsibility. That's, you know, the Bruins are paying him to get the team prepared and to play hard and to execute the systems that he has them implemented. And, the Bruins didn't make it in the playoffs, so that an element of blame certainly falls on the coach. The other extreme is, and man, this is interesting, but the entire idea of he hates young players and no young players have ever flourished. And boy, I was in several Twitter exchanges with that crowd yesterday. And guys, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, if that's what you believe, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. I'll just tell you this. I don't recognize any of your pictures of having ever been in the room or ever been around Claude or ever been around any of the players that you're so sure he hates and feel alienated. So I know that's kind of a low blow, but, you know, get off the couch, get out from behind your computer, and understand that, you know, you're entitled to that opinion, but it would be nice for you guys to present some actual evidence. It's just an extreme view. Julian doesn't hate young players. He just trusts players with experience, and there's a lot of stuff we don't see that goes on behind the scenes, things at practice. You know, the coaches talk to players, and then players go out and they execute. And when they're not doing the things that the coaches are telling them to do, the coaches notice that. And so it's probably not by accident that some of these players are sat down and not allowed to just keep playing if they're not doing the things that the coaches want. Now, we can argue all day long about whether Claude's system works or what the coaches are telling them to do is the right thing. But it's pretty easy to sit back there when you have no skin in the game and demand that that the coach play the guy you want to play. The biggest thing I saw all year was Colin Miller. Colin Miller should be playing, yada, yada. And you look, Colin Miller was a very skilled defenseman. You know, on paper, he's easily top two in terms of the best offensive ability that is present on the team. But he's also got a major work to do on the defensive aspect of his game. I've talked to several people within the organization and outside the organization, one pro scout for another Western Conference team, and he said, hey, look, you know, there's a reason that the Los Angeles Kings gave up Colin Miller in the Milan Lucic trade. I mean, he's a good prospect, but he has work to do. And so Claude Julien's not in the business of just developing a player over the entire course of the season. I mean, if it works out and the player's doing what needs to be done, that's one thing. But the fact that as the season went on, we saw less and less of Colin Miller until he was ultimately sent down to the American Hockey League, it's kind of telling. So I get the frustration, and I understand how people would have an issue with Claude Julien. But honestly, it's so easy to criticize the coach. It just gets a little tired and old. But at the same time, we've now witnessed two end-of-season flameouts in a row. The onus is on the coaches to get these players to play hard. And if these players truly respected Claude Julien and his staff of Doug Jarvis, Doug Huda, Joe Sacco, and they were really going to get out there and play hard for those guys, they didn't show it. So if the Bruins are going to make a change, certainly understand where they're coming from, and I guess we'll see who that is. We've heard rumors of Providence College coach Nate Lehman. He built a champion for Union College, although Rick Bennett was behind the bench when the Dutchmen won their first ever NCAA title. But then a year later, DeLehman did it in Providence. And he's a good college coach, and he's a good guy. You know, the Bruins have several PC products. Certainly, Noel Achari is the one that comes to mind. And he gives a lot of credit to Nate Lehman. The other guy I was thinking of was a bit of a Freudian slip there, but was Brandon Tanev. The Bruins didn't actually get him. No, he ended up with the Winnipeg Jets. They were in the running, and they brought him in off of for their development camp last summer. But ultimately, he had a really good, solid year with the Friars and ended up with the Jets, who went hard after him. So never mind that. So Lehman would be an intriguing possibility. I've seen Ted Donato's name thrown out there. I honestly don't know. What I do know is that that if they fire Claude Julien. He'll be picked up in about 5 minutes. Ottawa Senators are a logical landing spot, given that he's from that part of Canada. Certainly the Montreal Canadiens would like a do-over, given that they fired him. And who knows? If it's not those two teams, it'll be somewhere, because he's a proven winner, and he's the kind of coach who can, I think, effectively lead any team, whether that's a group of veterans or some younger players. And, you know, if you don't agree with me, that's fine. General manager management in general starts with, let's take it all the way to the top, to the ownership. The Jacobs families own the team for 41 years. They've got one Stanley Cup championship and numerous Stanley Cup final appearances in the time that they've owned the club. But they've only won the one championship in 2011. In the late 90s, the discontent with the Jacobs family came to a crescendo when there was no salary cap, and it was all about it was about how much money an owner was willing to spend. And some teams were spending freely, and other teams weren't. I think part of that was Jeremy Jacobs, but part of it was Harry Sinden, the longtime Boston Bruins general manager. I mean, he was an old school GM. He had presided over the team when hockey players made peanuts. So while Jacobs didn't perhaps put the emphasis on the team that fans maybe would have liked the owner to do, and he didn't open the checkbook as freely, I don't know how much of that exactly was Jeremy Jacobs' fault and how much of it was Harry Sinden holding the line. What I do know is that Jacobs was one of the hardliners leading the charge for a salary cap. And, you know, what can you say? I mean, it's we've got it. And law of unintended consequences now. There are some things about the salary cap NHL that are good and some things that are not so good. So, you know, ultimately, Jacob's family's been, for the most part, hands off and have let their GMs, whether we're talking Michael Connell, Peter Chiarelli, and now Don Sweeney, conduct business. The big question now lies with the crux of what are the Jacobs going to do now that the team has come so close but missed some glittering opportunities to make the playoffs in each of the last two seasons. What kind of accountability are they going to instill? Next guy in the food chain is Cam Neely, beloved player, really an icon, the premier power forward of the 80s and 90s, the late 80s and 90s, from the time he came in on his birthday in 1986, traded from Vancouver for Barry Peterson, and just multiple 50-goal scorer and would have put up a lot more numbers in Boston if not for degenerative hip and knees that cost him to have to retire from the game at age 31 when he was still in his prime. And it's a shame. One can only wonder what if. But as a vice president and then president of this team, he's a mixed bag. He's got a bit of a checkered reputation as a manager. Not sure what to make of his stewardship. One of the challenges is always when you have a beloved player who the fans really get behind and love as a player, doesn't necessarily mean that player is going to be a great manager or a great coach or a great scout. And this isn't just a conversation about Cam Neely. It's really a conversation about everyone. There are certainly former players that were stars and have gone on to greatness in various positions, management and coaching positions after their playing careers were over. They've succeeded as scouts or whatever. But there's no guarantee of what you're going to get. And I think Cam Neely's tenure in the Boston Bruins front office is open to criticism here. I think you can certainly question, how much of an influence does he have? And how dedicated is he to the day-to-day operations? And if he isn't that dedicated to the day-to-day operations, and how much influence is he and sway is he allowed to wield over the organization? And if the answer is a lot, then that might be a bit of an issue. because, you know, he's certainly a visible presence. Nobody doubts that. I mean, you know, I've seen him on the road trips, and he's a fixture in the at the press level nine, and he's around the team. How much power and authority and decisions he makes on the personnel matters, that's a whole nother ball of wax. And so I think, you know, given the recent results and some of the whispers you've seen in terms of maybe a bit of the power struggle that he had with Peter Chiarelli, you know, it's fair to question how effective Cam Neely is as the president of the Boston Bruins, whereas his legacy as a player is pretty solid. And I honestly don't think his legacy will ever be tainted the way Steve Kasper was when he was a really respected defensive forward. Prior to Patrice Bergeron, the only Boston Bruin who had ever won a Selke Trophy as the best defensive forward, and then benched Cam Neely during the 95-96 season as a healthy, you know, healthy bench. I mean, it wasn't a healthy scratch. He dressed Neely and Kevin Stevens and then left them on the bench and didn't play them. And that forever ruined Kasper's legacy in the eyes of many fans. And it's a shame because Steve Kasper, the player, was a heck of a player. And, you know, but he'll forever, I think, be, when people bring up Steve Kasper's name, he'll kind of be vilified as, you know, for what he did as coach, and ultimately lost his job at the end of the 96-97 season when the Bruins bottomed out and ended up with Joe Thornton as the number one overall pick. So management has a big hand in this. Don Sweeney, of course, talked about the moves he made. I won't go into too much detail on Don Sweeney other than to say that, you know, he's up against it. He certainly showed that he's capable of making bold moves, and I think he's going to have to do it again because, quite frankly, the status quo is not going to work. You know, certainly the central core of this team is good, but it's not good enough, and we saw that. Zdeno Chara is aging. I don't know that you trade a Zdeno. I don't know that you can unless he asks out. I mean, the guy's given you a decade. I mean, yeah, sure, you could trade him, but he would have to agree to it. I mean, given his current contract situation, he would have to agree to let you move him. And if he says no, then I think, you know, you just have to respect his wish. And yeah, you know, he's still a pretty big cap hit. But if that's the case, then the onus is on Sweeney and the Bruins to figure out how to put some better talent around Chara, because he can still be a contributor to the Bruins' fortunes. He's just not the player he once was. Now, as for Patrice Bergeron, I mean, I mentioned in the blog that it's fair to ask, you know, where was he yesterday? But ultimately, yeah, he's not going anywhere, and nobody should be blaming Patrice Bergeron for what happened. You know, he ultimately, he did what he was supposed to, and for much of the season, again, equaled his career best, or did he exceed it? I don't, off the top of my head, I can't remember if he ended up with 32 goals or 31, but ultimately, 30 goal scorer, and given what this team brought to the season, I mean, that's pretty impressive. He's in the running for another Selke, though. It sure looks like Anže Kopitar's got the media swell of attention this season, and when you look at his production, it wouldn't surprise me to see Kopitar capture the Selke this year, though. You know, Bergeron is certainly deserving, so he's the one guy who you keep, absolutely keep, and should spend the rest of his career as a Bruin. He's signed long-term, and there's no way the Bruins should be entertaining moving him. That leaves David Krejci and Tuukka Rask. I talked about them at length. I won't go into much more detail other than to say, you know, getting back to, you know, Krejci, you know, he's a good guy. He's a good player. He entered the top 20 of all-time scoring on the Boston Bruins this year. And that's no easy feat, but, you know, he's never been a guy who's gone out and racked up a ton of points for you. He doesn't have game-breaking speed. He's a player who's extremely cerebral and slows things down and can control the tempo of a game when he needs to, but he's not going to push the pace. I don't know. The biggest concern with him is he turns 30. Here in about 30 days, and he just doesn't have the speed, and he's doesn't have the durability, I think, to really live up to that $7.25 million a year price tag he comes with. So I'm being criticized for calling his contract an albatross, but I don't know what else to call it. I mean, if the Bruins want to move it, good luck. They're going to have a hard time. Some people have pointed to David Clarkson and Nathan Horton. Well, okay. But you have to find a team willing to do that, and then you have to find Krejci being willing to go to those guys. So you're already working from a constrained environment. You know, you can't, even if Sweeney had a general manager that was willing to entertain taking David Krejci on, you know, what are you getting in return? What do the Bruins have to give up David Krejci? That's going to be a tough sell. I think the Bruins are better off just keeping him for now and hoping he can stay healthy and get back to that 80-point threshold and then just get into the playoffs, because that's what he's great at. He's the franchise's current active scoring leader in the playoffs, but the last 2 years they haven't even made it into the postseason for him to add to those totals and to be that crunch time player that he earned such a positive reputation being earlier in his career. Tuukka Rask. Yeah, what do you do about him? First of all, I'm not blaming him for playing yesterday, even though I talked about him being, or should I say, for not playing yesterday. I talked about him being sick. That's unfortunate. I'm sure he didn't mean to get sick. And, you know, he was in a catch-22, because if he goes out there and he plays and he lays an egg and the Bruins, you know, let in a bunch of goals because he's off, then he's blamed because he played while he was sick and he shouldn't have. But because, of course, he didn't play, he's being blamed for not being tough enough. Look, I get that. That's not what this is about. But he doesn't get a cookie because he took himself out of the game either. And I see far too much of that. It seems like, you know, people who have the defending Rask thing kind of seems to be a cottage industry among some segments of Bruins fandom, and I just don't get it. I've never seen this with any player, where it just doesn't seem to matter what goes on. There's always an excuse. There's always a finger pointed in the other direction. It doesn't seem like Tuukka Rask is ever capable of having a bad goal put on him. And yesterday he was sick. I mean, he was sick, okay, but he didn't play. Most critical game of the season, and the guy didn't play. He wasn't available. Yes, life happens. I get it. But you don't get to throw it out there like it's some kind of badge of honor that he was sick. That is fair game to say, look, when the Bruins needed him, he wasn't there to be counted on. It may not have been by choice, and it may not have been by design, but why are you throwing that out there as a point of order to defend him about? It is what it is. Had he played, I don't doubt for a second the outcome would have changed one iota. The Bruins were not winning that game, not the way they played and the way the Senators played. The way the Senators played, I think, is far more important, because the Bruins had some chances. They just once again couldn't finish. Okay, but I think you give the Senators credit. But once again, enough with the Rask stuff. You know, he's 29 years old. He gets paid. He's one of the highest paid members of the team. He's a former Vezina Trophy winner. You don't get to just, you know, trot him out and hold him up as this bastion of greatness when everything's going well and everything's swell and Rask is awesome. And then when the team is struggling, throw everyone else in the club on the bus, but hold him, you know, pull him aside and say, well, he's not responsible for any of this because the defense stinks. Well, no, that's not how life works. And it gets back to what I said earlier about extremes, okay? The extreme side that says Rask, you know, is lousy and Rask is overpaid and Rask needs to go, they're not helping the situation. But the other extreme that says Rask is always blameless and, oh, woe is Tuukka Rask, and man, what do you expect? I mean, you know, any goalie would have a tough time with this game. Well, we don't know that. Okay, what I do know is I see a lot of times Tuukka Rask shaking his head, raising his arms, showing his teammates up, and looking genuinely disinterested and unenthused on the ice. I think there were certain nights that he didn't bring his best. And yes, he's human, and yes, you can't expect perfection, and I'm certainly not demanding that. But when you're the guy, you got to play like the guy. And there were some nights I just didn't feel Rask did. So enough on that. Honestly, if the Bruins are going to shake things up and get rid of the status quo, Rask makes the most sense. He's 29 years old. He's still good enough, plays well enough that some team out there is going to be really interested in him. He's only got 4 years left on his $7 million deal, so it's manageable. It's a good risk to take. He's not on the wrong side of 30 or getting ready to be on the wrong side of 30 for a lot of years. And I think ultimately, Don Sweeney can find a taker if they want. Yes, it would mean a complete rebuild. Yes, the Bruins would be taking major steps back in net. I get that. But they'd also be out from under that big contract, and they could better allocate those dollars and spend it elsewhere. And who knows? They might even get a young goaltender that gives them bigger bang for the buck. You know, certainly a player like Jake Allen has kind of what he's done for the St. Louis Blues. Those guys are out there. I don't know that Malcolm Subban is ready to do that yet, but you can find a bridge goalie who you can accept some risk with and maybe roll the dice on a Malcolm Subban or a Zane McIntyre and see what happens. But if you stick with Tuukka Rask, here's what I do know. He hasn't been good enough to get a mediocre team into the playoffs 2 years running now. So what's the point in holding on to him? The Bruins are mediocre. So holding on to them, great. They'll continue to be mediocre. But if you're happy finishing 13th or 14th every year, which makes you too good to get those high draft picks that are going to get you elite talent that you can actually rebuild around, if you're okay with that, then hey, just don't entertain any talk of Tuukka Rask and we'll all go away. And he can just stay here until his contract runs out and then go somewhere else in all likelihood. Me personally, I think if they're going to move someone out of the core, it makes sense for Tuukka Rask. But whether that comes to fruition or not, we'll see. So what's next? You know, a lot of holes to fill. I don't envy Don Sweeney one bit. We've got Louis Erickson. I think he's all but gone. You know, he could have a change of heart and stick around. But honestly, I think that although he did have a couple nice goals down the stretch, he just didn't do enough. And he's just not a difference maker. He's a solid guy. Good person, good teammate. He got 30 goals. Really only the second time in his career he's reached 30 goals. That's surprising. But he was always kind of hovering around 30 and scoring in the high 20s when he was in Dallas. He improved each of his 3 years in Boston. But I don't think he's worth the six-year, $6 million range deal that his agent, J.P. Barry, is looking to get him. So he'll probably go elsewhere. I think at this stage, best Bruins can do is flip his rights before the draft, before July 1st, to someone seriously interested in signing him so that they can have exclusive negotiating rights. The only way this changes, I think, is if he has a change of heart and is willing to take, you know, lesser term and lesser dollars to stay in Boston. But I think after seeing what we did and realizing, you know, he's not a difference maker, I don't think the team is going to push hard to try to keep him. Now, had he lit it up and been a major horse and they were in the playoffs and he was a valuable guy or more valuable than he was, and that's not to say he was a bum. He wasn't. He scored a big shorthanded goal against the San Jose Sharks, you know, scored a couple of key goals down the stretch, but there just wasn't enough. Just was not enough. He was more productive, you know, earlier in the season and when they really needed him to have a hot stick and to be a consistent offensive presence for him, he wasn't able to do that. So wish Louis Erickson well, but I think he's gone. And his, you know, his four some odd million, cap dollars can be invested and rolled towards Torrey Krug, who, as I mentioned earlier, he's up for a new deal. And if Jared Spurgeon's getting $5 million from Minnesota Wild, hey, I hate to break it to you guys. If the Bruins want to keep Krug, it's going to take at least five, maybe a little more. And that's why I say his four goals was probably a blessing in disguise. If he'd gone out and scored 12 or 15 or was pushing 20, not to mention all the assists he had and the minutes he played this year, I think Krug would be looking at a much bigger pay raise. So I think the Bruins will lock him into a solid extension of a good solid bump up from his current $3.4 million to probably around $5.5 million, and that's not a bad price to lock him in at. But really what the Bruins have got to do is they've got to add some more talent to that defense group. I think, you know, Zach Trotman's gone. They may try to move Joe Morrow, though I don't know what kind of value they would get for him. We're talking middling picks or you know, lower-end prospects, you know, similar guys that maybe were drafted high but just haven't performed very well. And Colin Miller will certainly get an opportunity again to try to play his way into the top four. But obviously the Bruins, you know, have a challenge. They've got to figure out how to trade for and acquire a legitimate number two defenseman, at least, and maybe one that has number one upside, and get a better, you know, all around defenseman, two way threat into the mix, one with NHL experience and ability, and one that can be retained for the longer haul. So if they go out and trade for a Kevin Shattenkirk, they have to allocate the money to keep him. Jonas Brodin is a name I've seen thrown around a lot. Brodin is a smart guy. I was never a huge Brodin guy in his draft year. I thought he was a solid player. I was a little surprised that he went off the board right after Dougie Hamilton. His personality, he's kind of quiet. I don't know how well he'd do in Boston. I mean, he's certainly a capable player. Yeah, but his numbers have really dropped off a cliff. So I don't know how much of the clamoring for Jonas Brodin is actually based on people watching him and thinking he'd be a good fit in this system, and how much of it is remembering that at one time, you know, he was a high draft pick and just, you know, basing it on that. But, you know, if the Bruins think Brodin would be the guy, then that's up to them to figure out. Other players that are you know, certainly talked about. You've got Hampus Lindholm in Anaheim. Hard to figure that they would trade him, but he's a name. Shea Theodore would be another one. I mean, the Ducks have a bevy of young, impressive defensemen, and you know, there are different options around the league. It's just going to be a challenge for Don Sweeney to go out and get one without paying an arm and a leg. But I've got to think one of those first-round picks will be coin in play for that. Probably the second pick, the San Jose pick. You know, who knows? Maybe both. Maybe a package of both to either move up or to get a legit player. But, boy, if they trade both of those first-round picks, they better be getting a heck of a player, because it won't be just picks. It'll be something else, too, that they'll have to give up. And, you know, you don't want to go too far over on the other side of you know, giving up your draft currency. They've already given up their third and fourth rounders for this year. They do have the 1 second rounder from the New York Islanders, which is a middle of the round pick. The second one that they got for the Johnny Boychuk deal. So I think, you know, defense is a priority in the offseason. Kevin Miller, Adam McQuaid, don't need them both. Unfortunately, McQuaid's contract doesn't make him very attractive to other teams. I really like Adam McQuaid in the right role as a bottom pairing guy. He's tough. He's gritty. He's a character guy. He plays the throwback old school game. Unfortunately, at $2.7 million a year, that's not a great value to have as a bottom pairing guy. He also, as is the case every year, because of the style he plays, he gets injured. He misses stretches of games. This year was no different. So Kevin Miller, kind of the same thing. You know, makes significantly less than McQuaid does, but you don't need them both. And I think the Bruins will probably part ways with Miller, keep McQuaid as their rugged guy, and look to upgrade elsewhere. Dennis Seidenberg. He was injured at the beginning of the year, and he was injured at the end of the year. I guess the season just kind of ended the way it began. 6 goals and a home loss. No Dennis Seidenberg. Opening night and, you know, the final game of the season. That's how the season started. That's how it ended. But unfortunately, Seidenberg has 2 more years to go. He's aging. He's been slowed down significantly by that knee injury. And it's a pretty rough show for him. Up front, Bruins have young players to put in, to work in. I don't think I don't know that going out and getting NHL talent is necessarily the answer up front. I think they should focus their energy on the defense and see what they can add. But really look at younger players like, you know, Frankie Vatrano. See if See if Seth Griffith is still hanging around. Who knows? I mean, Alexander Kokolechev, it looks like he's done, but he's at least played very well in the minor leagues. He had a big game today, productive game. He's been on fire lately. I think he's up around the top three in AHL in scoring. So maybe they can leverage Kokolechev to get another defenseman, as a package, or maybe as part of a forward upgrade. But they really need to focus on that third line, as I said earlier, trying to get some talent either to mesh better with Ryan Spooner. And look, Spooner's got some things to figure out. I mean, he's very good on the power play, but when they needed him at even strength, he had a rough start. And then he was really, what I noticed about Ryan Spooner, he was effective and capable when Krejci went out at the end of December, and he missed the Winter Classic, and Spooner was moved up for several weeks to that second line. He did pretty well. But down on that third line, it just seemed to be a struggle for him. And I hope they can figure it out. But if they just go ahead and send Ryan Spooner packing, once again, we're talking about half measures and playing around the margins. Going out and signing Keith Yandle and not bringing anyone else in, that's not going to get you a whole lot. I mean, is Keith Yandle a good player? Sure, absolutely. But he's going to cost a lot on the open market. And so Yandle plus someone else is what the Bruins need to be striving for, not just throwing a bunch of money at Keith Yandle and hoping that the hometown thing brings him home and then calling it a day. He's outstanding on the power play. He certainly would add an offensive element to the team. But Yandle is not someone you can count on to be your two-way top two, top one, defenseman game in and game out and expect to be a contender one day. He's a complimentary player. He's very good, Cushing Academy product, talented player, no doubt about it, no doubt about it. But as an unrestricted free agent, he's going to probably get a lot more than he's worth at his age and this stage of his career. So the Bruins need to be very careful in terms of how they proceed. If Yandle's in the mix, great, but there needs to be more. And if they can add Yandle and someone else like a Shattenkirk or any of the other younger defensemen I mentioned, hey, there's a chance. Madison Bowie from the Washington Capitals, man, if they could figure out a way to wheedle him away from McClellan at the Caps, man, that wouldn't be a bad move either. But bottom line, Bruins have some work to do. And no easy answers, for sure. It's a disappointing season. Can certainly understand the fan angst. And hey, look, I'm a passionate guy. I had some biting critique of Tuukka Rask earlier. I know I seem kind of down on things. Really, hey, it could be worse. The Bruins aren't a complete disaster of an organization yet. But what they do here this offseason is going to be hugely impactful to what they can do going forward. They've got some really nice young pieces in the David Pastrnak. You certainly look at the Zach Sinishin coming down the road eventually, but he's not ready to go. I mean, I've been watching Zach Sinishin on film all year, and while you love the 45 goals, I've also been watching him kind of cherry picking and waiting for opportunities and scoring chances. And I don't see a player who's figured out yet that he needs to get back in his own end, needs to be diligent along the walls and win puck battles and be a part of that transition game and not just be hanging out looking for the breakaway pass so that he can go in and score a highlight reel goal. Highlight reel goals are fun, but just because Sinishin scored 45 doesn't mean he's ready to be a Boston Bruin next year. Maybe he does it, maybe he doesn't. But if Sinishin isn't on the opening night roster next October, he's got to be back in junior. The Bruins cannot send him to Providence, and that's going to be a challenge for them. You don't want to rush these kids too much. They have a lot of nice pieces coming up through the organization, but they don't have a lot of guys that really scream at you and just shout that these guys are going to be high-end elite players. And picking 14th again this year, assuming they don't win the lottery somehow, they have a 1% chance to move up to the top pick, and then they have a slightly higher odds to move to the second or third pick, or they'll stay at 14. Hey, look, top 10 teams this year are getting some great players. 14 isn't that far away from 10, but once again, just like they were last year, they're kind of on the outside looking in. So while they'll get a nice player, at 14, assuming they stay there, it won't be one out without warts. But that's what we'll look at going forward. Season's over again. Thank you for reading the blog. Thank you for listening to my long, rambling podcasts. Hopefully you find this informative. If not, you signed off a long time ago. For those of you who don't know, I'll be off to Grand Forks, winging it to North Dakota this coming week for the Under-18 Championships. Very exciting time because most of the Under-18s in our Red Line Report, top 10, most of those players are going to be in that tournament. Now, we're talking Jacob Chikarin, we're talking Mikhail Sergachev, we're talking surprises like Dante Fabro, whose Penticton Vs were knocked off. You know, the Finns are, you know, certainly an exciting bunch are going to be there. So this is going to be a great opportunity to live scout some of the top options for the NHL draft and see if we can get a glimpse of who the next potential Boston Bruin might be. It's exciting, and I'm looking forward to it. So I hope you'll continue to tune in. Keep checking the blog daily. I can't promise I'll have something up every day, but I'll try to tweet out the links when I do. And I'm certainly going to have more podcasts. And I'm looking to try to get some guests on here so it's not just me talking. I would love to have Dominic Tiano and Reed Duthie at some point come on, and we could do a pre-draft podcast where those two fine gentlemen can bring their expertise on the Ontario Hockey League to bear, and it'll be a good time. But for now, that's the best I can do. I gave it my best shot in terms of breaking out what went wrong and what are some of the things that need to change going forward if the Bruins want to get back to their winning ways. It's certainly not it's not set in stone, and there's a lot of work to do. And I think the first domino to fall, obviously, is what's going to happen with Claude Julien. And once we see that, then the other things will start to take shape. And I think one thing's for certain, the status quo will not remain in effect, not the way things came apart again for the second year in a row. So for the Scouting Post, Kirk Ludeke, again, thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great week.